Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's a beautiful day where you are. It's a nice day here.
It is a beautiful day here, too, but I'm only 25 miles down the road.
Yeah, that's true.
Although
but sometimes you... But sometimes you have rain and I don't, so there you go.
That is true, too. That is, yeah, that definitely happens. Okay, so our book today is set a little further afield.
Just a little bit. It's a page-turner. It really is. You got to take some time to sit down and, you know, because really you want to know what's going to happen.
Well, our guest today is D.A. Bartley, also... That's her pen name, and we will be calling her Allison today. And the title of the book is Death in the Covenant, an Abish Taylor Mystery. And D.A. Bartley is a member of Daughters of Utah Pioneers. She traces her family history back to the earliest days of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. She spent much of her childhood in Utah, which is where this book is set, but her parents were incurable travelers. She was born in Scotland and lived in Germany, France, and Russia. After studying international relations, I wonder why, politics and law, D.A. worked both as an attorney and an academic in Manhattan. In the end, though, she could not escape her lifelong love of mysteries, and she lives in New York City with her family. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Allison.
Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here.
Now, you shared with us before we started where D.A., why you use D.A. Bartley on your books. You want to share that with our listeners?
Sure. As I explained to Caroline and Monica, I did think it through because I am such a mystery lover. And when I wrote this book, I was like, oh, my name, this is not, my married name is not a particularly good name, and I'm a big fan of P.D. James, and I thought, I'll just go with my maiden name, which is D.A. Bartley. I was named after my grandma, Donna Allison Bartley. And so the pen name is not all that original, I guess.
So it really is your name, but just...
It really is my name, except, well, now I'm D.A. von Rosenvinge. So you can understand, actually,
yes.
Bartley is a lot better. I took my husband's name over 25 years ago, and yes, there you go. So I concluded von Rosenvinge was just far too long to put on a cover. And it doesn't sound quite mystery-ish. I feel like Bartley's a better mystery author.
I don't know. Von Rosen? Rosen what?
Exactly.
So you grew up in Utah, did you? And this Abish Taylor grew up in a Mormon family, and that's your detective in this cozy mystery. Did you also grow up in the Mormon faith?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I grew up I was born in Scotland, but I have no memory of it. So my father was in graduate school at the University of Edinburgh. And that's why I was born in Scotland. And my parents moved back to Ogden, Utah when I was two. And it's funny because the setting for the book all sort of happened when I was visiting an old friend from high school who's moved up near a place that I remember loving so much as a kid, but we lived a little bit further away in Ogden and not quite such a picturesque part as where Abish has her place. But yes, I grew up in Utah, and I lived in Ogden until I was 10. And then we up and moved to France, and then we moved to Germany, and then we moved back to Salt Lake when I was about 15. And I went to high school in Salt Lake, and then I left for college. And I get back as much as I can because I miss those mountains.
So kind of the, the first question that comes to mind after reading this and knowing a little bit about your background is, Abish has left the Mormon faith, but she's still in Utah. She still loves her family. Some of her family doesn't want anything to do with her, but her father and brother are still, in her life. And how real is that for people who want to leave the Mormon faith, and how and why did you decide to write about that?
Oh, you know, that's a really good question, and I hope I can answer it. I do know, I have a lot of friends who have families where certain people have left, and some and other members of the family have stayed in the church. And I guess I always found that really interesting. I know for, I guess, anybody who comes from a really religious household, which mine was, I mean, you went to church every Sunday. They're basically your week of your events during the week were basically sort of various things for young women. And when you were a child, and then there were women's things and men's things, and all, you know, your social life was very much organized around the church. And when I was small, pretty much when I was a little kid, I didn't know anybody who wasn't Mormon. And then as I got older, I had friends who started leaving the church, and I started to see how different families handled that, because when your church is so central to your life, there's a tension for families that I feel like. I now live in New York City, and I have some people who read my books, and they're like, wow, I don't, you know, do people really go to church that much? And I'm like, yeah, actually, people do go to church that much. That's really how, you know, that is part of life, and I feel like how people navigate that is really hard, because you've got, and I guess that might be why the tension's so good and why I was drawn to it, because family is really important to me, and sort of your spiritual life is very important to everybody. So families and spiritual life are important, very, very basic foundational parts of life. And if those two things don't mesh, how do we navigate that in a compassionate, good way? And I think it's hard. And I think Abby, every time I come back to the theme of Abby, particularly with her older brother, and that relationship is so strong, and I love him, and her dad, and that relationship is a little bit more fraught. And I just, I discover new things every time I sit down to write about that. And I suspect there's no one-size-fits-all answer about, you know, how families manage when someone leaves a faith that is foundational to their religion, to their lives. And in Mormonism, it's maybe even a step further, because the afterlife is such an important part of life right now. So the temple ceremonies, people, you know, you are sealed to your family for time and all eternity. A marriage is for time and all eternity. So when a family member leaves the faith, there absolutely is this tension.
And have you experienced that in your own life as well?
I have. I do. I am really lucky. I think things have. Now, let me speak in English in a real sentence. I have a wonderful family, a wonderful, you know, nuclear family. Sadly, you know, my mother passed away 5 years ago, but I'm really close to my dad. I actually talk to my brother just about every day. Mm. And then my extended family, most of them still live in Utah. I have one second cousin who lives up in Vermont. He moved there. He's a dentist now up there. And then I have a number of cousins who've now moved to Idaho, a few cousins who lived in Texas for a while. And everyone has been really supportive and really open-minded about, you know, different paths that everyone takes. I have seen this get better over the last 20 years. I know I had friends who left the church about 20 years ago, and it was a much tougher road than it is now, which is, I think, a good thing for everyone.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Does that answer your question?
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean,
they're
hard subjects, right?
A lot of religions have, they are hard subjects. And, you know, there are many religions that have some form of excommunication or shunning. Some of them are more severe than others, and I think as a religion matures, that maybe becomes less harsh, you know.
Yes. Oh, you're completely right. That's such a good insight. Yeah, I agree with you.
I mean, Mom, have you seen a difference even in your lifetime in the Catholic Church at how people react if someone leaves the church?
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Yeah, it's more. They're still inclusive if they want to come and worship. They're not shunned or looked down on or anything. They're just So yeah, that's true, and I'm glad to know that there are other faiths that do that as well.
I wonder, we grew up, I grew up in Amish country in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and the shunning, shunning was always something we understood as part of the Amish faith, where somebody would really be completely cut out of the family. I wonder if that's relaxed in that religion also.
I wonder.
That's a really interesting question. I am the biggest fan of Linda Costello. I love the Kate Burkle series, which is in Amish country. Mm. And she does talk about shunning, or it's a theme in a number of her books. But that's a really interesting question. I don't know the answer. I'd be curious to know, though. I'll have to research that.
I would, too. Now, Death in the Covenant is not the first book in your series, right? How many books are there?
It is the second book. Okay. The first book came out last August, and it Blessed Be the Wicked.
And that, of course, was Abish Taylor as well. And
yes.
Not having read that and starting with this one, I feel like you did a really good job of kind of filling in some of the background without spending too much time on it where it detracted from the current story. How do you go about doing that?
Oh, first of all, thank you for saying that. I don't know how you do it. I think you have a good editor. And I think as a writer, I find that you learn, like we all do. Like every single day you get up and you're like, I learned something yesterday. And I think I'm trying to be have a lighter hand with dropping information, but I do think I really have to give my editor credit. I wish I could say, oh, well, it's just because I know how to do it, but I don't think, but that would be lying.
Well, you said that you have to leave some things unresolved as you move ahead, but I think writing a series would be very interesting, but what are some of the challenges presented by writing a series?
I do love series so much, and I read them myself, so but now that I've written two and I'm working on the third, I do see that there are challenges. And I guess I would say the things that I love about a series is I get to leave things messy. So as I was talking about Abby and her dad, and she's now beginning to have a romantic interest, I don't have to resolve it by the end of the book, and that's okay. I feel, quite frankly, that a series kind of reflects life more realistically that way. I mean, I would love it if my life sort of at the end of every day, at the end of every week, it was tied up nicely in a little bow. mine isn't. I don't know. Maybe yours is, but mine is completely not like that. So I see that's an advantage, but the same thing is a disadvantage for a series, because when you have a standalone, or so I believe, since I've never written a standalone, although I'm sort of working on one, I see the advantage with a standalone, and you can have all of the storylines. You have, the beginning, the middle, the end for everything, and you can resolve things. And there's that's satisfying as a reader.
That's true. And I know in TV series, when you talk about the romantic interest, that kind of the romantic interest never gets to be resolved often. Because once it is, it's like, where does the story go from there? And is that, now, of course, the romance is not the forefront of your series, but I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know, when you were just discussing why, you don't want the romantic tension resolved, I don't know what, it's popped into my head. I'm like, yeah, making toast in the morning on a Wednesday when it's rainy and miserable, that's not nearly as much fun to read about as the romantic dinner with candlelight.
Right.
Maybe that's part of it, is we all we deal with the toast on a miserable morning on Wednesday too much, and so it's nice to have, to read a book where there are lots of romantic dinners with candlelight.
Mm-hmm. And the will they or won't they get together? And
Exactly. It's a little bit more fun. I don't know if Abby and Flynn will where everything will lead. I do. I like him though.
Oh, he's a great guy, yeah. No doubt about that. Man, he just steps in and helps without being overbearing, without taking over.
Yeah, right.
I mean, can you find me a guy like that?
I think
yeah.
Gosh. Okay, so goodness. When you plot out your books, do you already know what the ending's going to be and how's it going to determine or?
I call myself now, the first book was, I was complete pantser. I had no idea where anything was going. I'll tell you like how the first book came about, and we already started off with some tough topics, so I'll just explain how the first book was written, which I think gets to your point of whether I'm a pantser or a plotter. I completely was a pantser. My mother, as I said, passed away about 5 years ago, but she had very early Alzheimer's, and there was about a 10-year decline, and over that period of time, I was back in Utah really as much as I could be back in Utah. And at one of those times, I went to visit this friend who lives up north of Ogden in Pleasant View, and she lived next door to this enormous house that had been empty. It was right after that, like, there were all these houses that had been built and then didn't sell, and it was one of those. And I got back to New York with my family, and somehow that empty house was sticking in my head. And I came back from a run one morning, and I just started writing. I had never written fiction ever. I have always read mysteries. Like, my first book, grown-up book, when I was little, was my grandma gave me an Agatha Christie, and then I just devoured them all, and I remember back when we'd make a big bowl of popcorn, and this was back when you couldn't record TV shows, so you had to, like, watch it when it was on, and I would sit with my grandma, and we watched mysteries, we read mysteries, this was part of just, you know, our life, but I never tried to write one, so I sat down, and I wrote 7 chapters. Disastrous 7 chapters. It was not genius, but I wrote 7 chapters, and then the next week, my daughter, and this is life. My daughter was the goalie for her lacrosse team at school, and she successfully defended the goal with a penalty kick, but she did it and with her helmet, and she ended up with a concussion.
Oh.
And so she had to be home for a few weeks, and the podcast that had gotten her, see now, if I had your podcast back then, I would have been fine. Maybe the book wouldn't have been written, but she didn't like anything I had given her to sort of listen to. And she said, well, Mommy, what are you writing? And I told her, and she's like, well, why don't you read it to me? So I read everything that I had written, and she looks up at me, because she can't look at a screen, she can't use her computer, she can't watch, I mean, not her phone, nothing, right?
Whoa,
so for a teenage girl, this is a disaster. And she says, what happens next? I said, I don't know. And she said, well, go write and come back. So for 2 weeks, that's what my 2 weeks was basically that. I was making her soup, and I was writing and then reading to her. And by the time she was back to school, I was about halfway through a book. And, you know, I was brought up, you know, finish what you start. So I finished it. So for that book, and the last scene in that book, when I finally knew it was all coming to an end, I knew it was coming to an end, but in those last chapters, I still was not exactly sure how it was going to end up. Now for this book, I realized pantsing it can be great, and I still actually don't know at the beginning of chapters where things will go, but when you start having to write on a deadline, you're like, maybe I should think about this to make sure that this story can hit all the points that it needs to hit, rather than make it 50,000 words in and go, oh my goodness, this doesn't go anywhere. So now I'm pretty much a pantser because I like to be surprised. I mean, I love it when I'm writing, when there's a conversation. Somehow it happens the most with Abby's dad, that he'll say something and I'll go, oh my goodness, yeah. So I like that aspect, so it's not all planned out beforehand, but it's kind of important to have, or at least I think if you're working on a deadline, I need to have a little bit of an idea of where things will go. So the second book was some plotting, mostly pantsing.
So did you know who done it?
In the first book?
In
or
the second?
In the second. In the second. Yeah, I did. I mostly. But you know, I think you always want a few different options, and maybe I hope that makes it more fun for the readers, because as I'm writing, there are sometimes where I'm like, oh, I thought this was going to go this way, and it doesn't go that way. And I found that it's kind of important to trust your gut that's telling you, no, this is not the right path to follow. And then, so there were a few people that I thought were likely suspects, and then as the story evolved, it sort of becomes clearer and clearer who done it. There we go.
We had plenty of options here. There were plenty of options you could choose from.
True.
That was good. That was good.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is D.A. Bartley, author of Death in the Covenant, an Abish Taylor mystery. Now, is Abish a common name, Mormon name? Because it was an unfamiliar name to me.
It was familiar to me, but it is not common. Growing up in Utah, I had lots of guy friends who were named after prophets or people in the Book of Mormon. It's really common for boys to be named after book of, you know, people in the Book of Mormon or prophets or Mormon leaders. Not so many girls. You know, there's Mary and Sarah, you know, some biblical names, but not, you know, it's not so common. And Abish sort of came to me. She was sort of very strong character, and I was like, what? But I didn't know her name. I kind of knew her last name was Taylor, because I wanted her to be connected to sort of Mormon aristocracy, so she's descended from the third prophet of the church. But I didn't know her first name, but I thought, you know what, let me flip through the Book of Mormon. And I knew that I had some names, and as soon as I saw Abish, I was like, oh, that's it. That's it, Abish Taylor. I don't know any. I've never met anybody named Abish. I don't know if it's really common, but that's her name, and that's why she has her name.
And, of course, she goes by Abby. Which makes it a little easier for the rest of the world to understand.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, you know, we touched on this a little bit, but when you're writing about the Mormon church, is that controversial at all for you to be writing about this?
You know, yeah, I guess. Again, like this it's a you know, a topic that's a serious one. And before the first book came out, I actually reached out to all of my friends who are very active in the church and family members, and just said, if you don't want a sort of a very nuanced, if you don't, you know, don't buy my book just because you're my friend and family. You know, in the first book, the opening scene has someone in their temple clothes, and I describe it all. And you're not supposed to describe all of that. And so, so to answer the question, can it be slightly controversial? Absolutely. I'm happy. All of my research, all of my doctrine, all my scripture stuff is accurate, and I've had no comment or feedback where anyone has said, oh, you got this wrong, which is good. Having said that, I feel like, and maybe this is getting back to the point we were making earlier about maybe, you know, religions becoming or growing up, younger religions growing up. So like the Amish and Mormons are young religions, right? And I think that we're all ready to sort of see both the good and the bad. I don't think any particular religion has a monopoly on either goodness or badness. And I feel like that's what I do in my books, is there are good guys and there are bad guys. I mean, the bad guys are really bad and not even remotely based on anything in reality. They're just good, bad guys. But some people don't want to read about that. And I can understand that.
Yeah, they don't want a church leader to be the bad guy.
Yes, exactly. You know, and that's fair. That's okay.
When I was younger, like a teenager, I used to love reading, talk about series books. It was a priest who wrote these mysteries. Father Andrew.
Father Brown?
No, Father Andrew Greeley was his name. Oh, yeah. And a lot of times there were people in the church who were the villains in those. You remember his books, Mom?
Yeah, vaguely, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think that's really great, though, you know, to just be reminded that, you know, we all have to try to be good, and going to church every Sunday doesn't actually, you know, make you necessarily all that much better.
Right, right.
Than not.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was just looking up, he was still writing into the 2000s, and I was certainly reading his books back in the 70s and 80s. So
good for him.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Wow.
I'm going to have to check it out. I have not read these. So I'm definitely going to check these out when we get off the phone.
Well, as I'm looking, I guess the earliest ones were the early 80s. So I wasn't a teenager then. I was a young adult. Nope, there's a 1979.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. 70s. Yeah. A lot of books. Anyway, so how many books do you intend to have in this series?
As many as my publisher will let me write.
Oh.
I am working on the third one, which I think is going to tie up, when we were talking about the loose ends, will tie up a number of loose ends that sort of have existed at the end of the first and the second book. But I'll be honest, Mormon history is got lots of room for, you know, strange little things that make murder mystery writers very happy, and they are very sort of intriguing, fun things to play with. So there's a lot of stuff.
Is there anyone else who's writing books set in the Mormon community like this, mysteries?
The Linda Walheim mystery series? Meta Ivy Harrison, yes,
okay.
She does ones that are current, they're set in current day Utah. Yes,
okay.
She does.
Okay.
And they're lovely.
Wait, how accurate is the history and doctrine brought up in the book? I mean, there's so much history here, and, you know, because there's just a lot of things have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, so how accurate is it, you try to stay as accurate as possible, I'm sure.
I do. I try to be 100% accurate. I'm sure I'm not, right? but I do. I, as you know, sort of I'm an academic and a lawyer by training, so trying to get the stuff that's supposed to be factually right matters to me, so I really try. I tried my best to be, completely accurate as far as one can be, right? I mean, when you talk about historical documents, you know, but I do try to sort of portray that too. If there are rumors of something, but nobody can really nail it down, I try to sort of make that clear, rather than sort of saying, well, you know, we know this for sure. But yeah, I do really try to be accurate on that. And yes, you know, when I'm writing, I have all of my stacks of books and I triple, quadruple check, and then my editors triple and quadruple check. So that matters to me. I don't know that it really matters for a good story, but it matters to me.
Well, it does, and it should. It should matter to you, and that's good. Yeah.
Now, one of the main themes in Death and the Covenant, or sort of one of the underlying causes of an issue, is that there's more young women who have stayed in the faith, and more of the young men have left, and so there aren't enough men for these women to marry and have children with, and the only way they can have a great afterlife is through marriage. So how accurate is it that this disparity between the numbers of men and women?
That should be spot on. And I was inspired to write this book because I read an article that was written a few years ago, 2015, I think, where the writer was comparing two very religious, conservative religious communities, an observant sort of, I guess, Orthodox community here in Brooklyn, and then looking at Mormons in Utah. And in both cases, both communities had this problem where right now they have a lot more women of marriageable age than young men. And I read the whole article. It was fascinating. It was interesting to see the parallels between these faith communities that probably don't think of themselves as being all that similar. and how, you know, how much was, you know, just as universal if, you know, if that's one of the goals of being part of the community. So I read this, and then I remember the stories that I was told back in the 70s when I was really little, and before the internet and before all these links where we can find out so much information. But I remember being told at Sunday school, you know, why did Joseph Smith take more wives? Why did Brigham Young take more wives? And I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting. Maybe we should see where this goes, because it reminded me of these stories I was told in Sunday school.
Now, as a woman reading about the belief systems surrounding women and kind of the restrictions on women in the Mormon faith, I'm like, I would think women would be the first ones out the door, because the men have all the power, it seems like. So why are young men leaving and young women staying?
That is a really interesting question, and I don't have a good answer for that. And I have talked to a lot of my friends who are men, who some are, many still in the church. Most of them went on missions, which you know, most young men do. And there isn't a good answer. I mean, this article that was written about these two faith communities, there the thesis was that men just have an easier time leaving things, and women tend to take care of all of the social components of the faith community, which keeps them in it as well, you know, because they do all the baking, all of the things where, you know, you're helping your neighbors, all of that kind of thing. And so this was part of the theory, but I don't know. What do you think? Do you have an answer for that?
Well, maybe it's harder for women to break away from their parents.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's more attachment there.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, it's a personal choice. And so I can imagine, if you were like a sociologist, every individual who leaves or doesn't leave is making really personal choices. And so I do wonder from, and that, I'm sure that would be part of the calculus.
Well, yes.
And also the young men who go out in the, you know, go out into the community and so forth, they are exposed to a lot more things than the women are.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's part of it too.
Yeah.
Do women do they have any kind of mission trip? The women?
They do. Now they do. When I was in high school, almost all of the guys I knew went on missions, and very few of the women went on missions. But that was when the age that you went on a mission was 19 for men, and I think it was 21 or 22 for women. Most women got married. Most of my friends were married before they were 21. Mm. So they just didn't go on missions. Now, both men and women can go, and I think the age is like 18, 19. So they go, they finish high school and they go for, you know, 18 months, 2 years. It depends. The rules governing missions have changed a lot in the last few years for, I think, all sorts of reasons. And there are more women going now, but this is a new thing.
Okay. So maybe the numbers will balance out in the future,
yes.
but not in the right direction.
Actually, you're so right. That's such a good point. It might not be a problem for much longer.
Yeah. Well, Allison, why don't you read a little bit from Death in the Covenant?
All right. I'm going to read from chapter 1.
All right.
Darn! Please be a wrong number. Abby had drifted to that critical junction between pleasant drowsiness and total unconsciousness when her phone went off. Her body craved sleep. Just one night of uninterrupted rest. One night with no nightmares. One night when she didn't lie awake for hours staring into the darkness. It had been too many months to count now. John had suggested she see someone, his big brother way of letting her know he was worried. He had broached the topic a couple of times in gentle, oblique ways, which made Abby feel ungrateful for being irritated. Her phone buzzed two more times before she could focus enough to read the numbers on the screen. It was Clark. She swiped to the right to answer the call. Taylor, there's been a car accident on Route 39. Jim Clark, Abby's partner, sounded chipper. He probably never had trouble sleeping. The driver's dead. An old guy, already called the doctor working as ME tonight. The chief said we should just handle it. I don't think he wants to get out of bed for a drunk driver. I'll be right there. Abby forced her body upright, the latest Tana French falling to the ground as she shifted. She picked up the book and placed it on the coffee table next to a nearly full cup of passion flower tea. Granted, reading suspense probably hadn't been the best choice for inducing sleep, but she'd hoped the herbal tea's calming qualities would do the trick. Abby climbed up the stairs to her bedroom. She pulled on jeans and a t-shirt, then laced up an old pair of hiking boots. As she walked back to the kitchen, to the front door, the coffee pot called to her, but there wasn't time to brew a fresh one. In an act of optimism, she picked it up. It was heavy. Abby poured day-old coffee into a thermos, grateful for small blessings.
Do you want to go on a little?
Should I keep going? Bit. Okay.
Yeah,
right.
I don't want to bore anyone. I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you. The end of Abby's long driveway was Route 39. Like a lot of small canyon roads in Utah, it was treacherous and narrow. Abby's cabin wasn't far from the crash site. It wasn't long before she saw the glow of flares and police cars on the side of the road. Nearly half of the Pleasant View City Police Department was there. Clark and the two other full-time officers. The area had been cordoned off, and the three men were searching the ground. Abby parked her old Range Rover next to the squad car, near cement blocks that had seen better days. It had been decades since politicians in any of the nearby towns had had either the money or political will to spend on infrastructure to prevent exactly what had happened tonight. Clark looked up when he heard her car door open. He waved. The narrow shoulder of the road dropped precipitously to the creek below. Streams in the canyons were fast-moving with snowmelt this time of year, cutting jagged edges into the mountainside. Abby hiked down the steep embankment to where the car was crumpled. The back of the dark car was in nearly perfect condition, even though the automobile had taken a nosedive into the rushing creek. Despite efforts to light the scene, the darkness made it impossible to see much of the front, let alone who was or what was inside it. "What do we know about the driver?" "Nothing," Clark answered. "We can't touch the body until the ME gets here and does his thing. It looks to me like he drove straight off the road." "Anyone see anything?" Beyond the lights the officers had set around the car, there was nothing but blackness. Nobody lived anywhere near this winding stretch of the canyon. Clark shrugged. "Anyone check up there?" Abby pointed to the other side of the creek. There was an unofficial campsite just past the first ridge where local teenagers liked to hang out, drink beer, and do whatever teenagers did when left to their own devices. It hadn't been so long ago that she'd spent the occasional weekend evening up a canyon, beyond the careful watch of parents and church leaders. Abby couldn't see light from a campfire, but if she was lucky, someone might be up there. Someone who could have witnessed the crash. Keep going?
Yeah, just a little more.
Just a little more, okay. Yeah. Clark kicked the dirt. No. Abby knew he was embarrassed that he hadn't already thought of checking the site. But Clark probably hadn't been the kind of teenager who hung out at non-sanctioned campsites. It wouldn't have occurred to him. "No worries. You stay here to meet the ME." Flashlight in hand, Abby crossed the stream with dry feet, courtesy of two fairly stable rocks and some luck. From there, it was a steep but not difficult climb up a well-worn, dusty path. As she stepped into the clear area, the breeze shifted so that the pleasant smell of campfire smoke was unmistakable. A few large trunks served as benches around a fire pit, deep red embers still glowing beneath the wet, charred remains of the logs.
All right. That was D.A. Bartley reading from Death in the Covenant, an Abish Taylor mystery, and you are listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline.
See, you want to know if there was somebody there, and you want to know who was in the car.
Questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are there any characters in this book that somebody reading it would say, "I think that's based on me"?
I don't think so. Actually, I've never thought about that.
I'm just wondering, like your older brother or your dad or...
Well, okay. I would say this. It is true. I am very close with my brother, and we do talk almost every day. And I think the moment... Now, my brother is younger than I am, and this is Abby's older brother. But I guess... I like that. That's an important relationship, and I think it is for Abby, and I know, like, for me in my own life. So my brother, I hope, like, the good aspects, probably it's true, maybe all the good aspects. My brother is a really great guy and has always just, you know, been so open to everybody and is, you know, and is always willing to help out and is thoughtful and caring. And I think, you know, Abby's brother, John, is that way too. And so there's probably some of that. My dad, that's interesting. Yeah, there might be some aspects of Abby's dad, like, that is probably also true with my dad. I mean, my father is sort of interested in an academic sort of absent-minded professor way, although he was not a professor at BYU. And so maybe there are some similarities there, but I think most of the characters kind of grew up themselves, but they clearly, you know, it's because of people I've met and I know and yeah, you know, little bits and pieces. So undoubtedly someone who knows how brains work better than I do might be able to answer that question better.
And how much of you is there in Abby?
I did have it in the first book. You don't see Abby. I don't think I have her go on any runs in this book. I did in the first book, and my editor's like, you got to cut these scenes where she goes running every morning. I do. I am a person who likes to sort of sweat it out first thing in the morning because it just sort of clears my head, gets me ready for being productive for the day. So that's true, but I'm not tall. I don't have lovely hair like Abby has. I'm not, you know, I would love to have Abby a lot of the things in Abby's life, but no, my I've got short blonde hair and I'm kind of short and I'm a lot older than Abby.
But I mean, that's just the surface. What about underneath? The curiosity, you know, the kind of stubbornness.
I bet there would be people who would say the stubbornness. And I think we do like to cook. Abby cooks. And I think actually in all the books, there are scenes where she's cooking. She cooks tacos with Flynn. I love to make tacos. So maybe the cooking thing, that probably comes from, I like to be in the kitchen and cook. You know, I like the process of slicing and dicing and prepping for a meal. And Abby does too most of the time, unless she's exhausted, which is probably true of all of us, right?
Yeah, really.
Unless we're exhausted, in which case someone else can do it.
She also seems to quite like wine.
She does like wine.
I was pleased, and because obviously either you know something about wine yourself or you're did some research, but you put in a couple of less common varietals, that one of which I'm particularly fond of, which is Grüner Veltliner.
Oh, you and, do? You like Grüner Veltliner?
Yeah, I do. It's a white that's German, I think. Is it, or is it Austrian?
Austrian, yeah.
When I was in Austria and Germany a couple years ago.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's one of my favorite whites. It's a little less sweet than a Riesling.
Yes. No, you're completely right. I like it. Okay, all right, there's that too. I like wine. Abby likes wine. Yes.
And
yes,
then the,
okay,
and then
there you go.
There was a red, too, that you mentioned, Monta something, Monta Pulsia.
Did she have a Montepulciano?
Yeah,
she might have.
Yeah, she had that one, too. So I'm like, okay, here's someone who knows her wine.
Yeah, okay, this is true. Those are wines that I drink from time to time.
Yeah, they're not all that easy to find sometimes. I mean, a good wine store obviously will have them, but, you know, they're not going to be on every restaurant's wine list.
No.
And, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like a Grüner. Yes, I like a Grüner too, completely.
Yeah. So I like, that was something that I certainly identified with Abby about. And it's not like I drink wine that much, but when I do, I like to try different varieties. I, you know, don't give me a Merlot, you know.
No, there's something nice. I also think when I'm riding with Abby, particularly if, you know, if the day's been, you know, particularly brutal for her, you're like, yeah, you know, you have a glass of wine, slow down for just one moment, sit down and let that pass and leave. And a glass of wine can do that.
And it's supposed to be very good for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a health food.
Yeah. Well, in the Blue Zones project, which was, you know, to try and help people get healthier habits, one of the things you got points for was having a glass of wine at the end of the day, especially if you
really
did it with, yeah, especially if you did it with friends.
You know, that is nice.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that it's with friends because mm-hmm. that's it. You slow down and you connect with other people
right.
over something that's enjoyable.
Right.
I like that.
So, Caroline, were there some things about, did you learn some things about the Catholic Church or the, excuse me, the Mormon Church when reading this that you didn't know before?
Oh, absolutely, because I didn't know anything about it, to say the truth. And I was wondering, how familiar with the Mormon Church do you need to be to read this book, read this series? And I think you learn some things, so I don't think you have to be familiar when you start out, do you?
I hope you don't. I don't think, when I first started writing, I don't think I set out to write sort of Mormon murder mysteries. I was thinking of like a classic mystery, which is what mm-hmm. I love to read myself. And I knew that writing was going to be hard enough as it is. So I wanted to write with as much, knowing as much stuff already as I could, right? So
right.
it was going to, so setting it in Utah, you know, that, well, as I said, there was the house in Utah. It was going to be in Utah. And the rest of it happens. I think also like the themes, I mean, all religions like to think of themselves as being so unique and different. But I hope they're universal things. And yes, there are some things, particularly in this book, where they are probably distinctly Mormon. But probably a lot of people who are Mormon don't know some of the things in here because it is a long time ago, and it's not something that is talked about a lot. So I imagine that maybe Mormons themselves would find more things, learn more things than even non-Mormons because, you know, this isn't something that we talk about a lot.
Now, one of the things I found interesting was this idea, and I'm not sure if this came from a real study or if it's something you created, but that Mormons were actually more against polygamy than non-Mormons today.
Yes.
Did that come from a real study?
No. Well, okay. Not that I know of.
Ah.
I'll answer it that way. Could somebody have done a study like that? Could the church have paid for a study like that? Absolutely. My experience, though, is that generally that Mormons have become – I mean, I remember growing up thinking that polygamy was a horror, and it was a really awful, awful thing. And I felt, I think there was a collective sense of shame at a certain point about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think now people are starting to, as more time passes, I have friends who now sort of joke about, you know, where the different wives were buried in cemeteries and say, you know, that actually there was one of my friends, his great-great-grandfather had, I don't know, four wives in Salt Lake. And after they had all passed away, the wives, everyone had passed away, but the wives have all made it clear that they did not want their cemetery to be the same one as the husband's, but the wives were all happy to be together.
Oh.
That's not the sort of joke. I know, exactly. Isn't it good?
Yeah.
And so I think that's a joke that can happen now among Mormons, I think. It's not a joke that would have happened, I think, 30 years ago.
Mm.
And so I think things are evolving.
But hopefully not back to polygamy.
Yeah, I'm not advocating for that.
So, Allison, you mentioned that you started writing this sort of your first book in the series kind of almost accidentally. How did mm-hmm. you go about finding a publisher?
Oh, this is another sort of another funny thing. My kids were getting older. And I was sort of getting in the process of going back to working full-time as a lawyer. Even went, bought myself a nice, staid black suit with sensible heels, was all sort of ready that I was, you know, I was going to get myself ready to go back full-time. And I was working with a friend of mine who you know, can help with helping me with my resume and this. And he just sort of out of the blue asked me, he says, well, what have you been doing? You know, what are the other things you've been doing? I said, well, you know, I wrote this manuscript. He said, really? He says, it's a mystery? I said, yeah. He says, hey, I love reading this. And he was going away on holiday. Send it to me. I'm like, okay. Now, he happened to have known a few people in the publishing industry in New York, and he forwarded, after he finished it, unbeknownst to me, forwarded it to one of them. And then I got an email in my inbox that was like, hey, we're interested in publishing this, but I don't have a query letter. I don't even know your name. I just have the manuscript. And I'm like, my heart is like completely in my chest. Like it was insane. Having said that, I had gone to some writers' conferences at that point, and I had met with some agents, but I did not have an agent at that point. I did within a day of having that conversation with the publisher. There were a few agents who had sort of said, hey, you know, we're sort of interested, and I am so thrilled that I'm now represented by Paulo Meunier. But that's how it happened, was sort of backwards, in that the publisher said, yeah. And then I'm like, I need an agent really quickly.
Okay, Abby, or Allison. Sorry.
That's okay. I like Abby.
Over the years, we have heard some really long and arduous pathways to publication, and we've heard some fairly easy and smooth ones, but I think yours takes the cake.
For long and arduous.
No.
You know, that's okay. Yeah, I think the path, well, yeah, all right.
Yep. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And did you get a multi-book, did you get a series deal right out of the gate?
No, I did not. But there was talk at the first conversation. There, the question was posed whether I had ideas for more books. And the interesting thing was, and I guess maybe this is maybe something I should pass on. I went to a writer's conference maybe a year before I was contacted by the publisher, because I was like, okay, I'm writing this stuff. I should be serious. And one of the sort of rumors that was going around, and a few people had sort of said this, don't go to publishers or agents saying you want a series because that's scary. You know, don't talk about a series. So I had been very careful in my conversation with my publisher to not say that I had ideas for other books in the same series. And then when my publisher was like, well, we think of this as a series, and then I'm like, oh, yes. And then I'm like, okay. So I feel like maybe to pass on to people who are interested in writing, do sort of follow your gut, because the advice out there may feel wrong. And it kind of did to me, because I had thought of it as a series of saying, oh, I shouldn't be so open about that. And the fact is, that actually wasn't particularly good advice for me. You know, and I guess that's one of those things I guess we all sort of struggle with in our own lives, that things that work for one person may not work for another.
That's very true. And of course, it may be a little different, like if you first send out a query letter. But I would think that publishers of mysteries, they do tend to be series. And I don't know that they'd want to spend a lot of time promoting a standalone. But I could be wrong.
Well, you know, I don't know. Does anybody know really the publishing industry very well? It seems to me there's a lot of people are loving these sort of domestic suspense standalones.
Yes.
That's really popular right now. And like the classic mystery is sort of not the thing that everybody is talking about. But I completely understand with you, because I like to read series. Like, I like to get to know the detective. I like to get to know the people, of whether it's an amateur or a professional, and get to know the people in their lives. That's what I gravitate towards, and there are only so many hours in a day. So I feel like I probably don't read what is representative necessarily. Mm. I try to, but I gravitate towards what I love, which is mysteries.
And do you have a favorite series right now other than your own?
Oh, definitely. I love, as I mentioned, Linda Castillo, who does the Amish stuff. I absolutely love her.
And you got a blurb from her on your cover. Congratulations on that.
I did. I have to tell you, I had such a massive fangirl moment. She is the most generous. I've never met her in person, but she has been so kind to me and so wonderful. And that's kind of true, I think, of the whole sort of mystery writing community, is people are so nice. Now, my theory on this, and you tell me if you think this is true, my theory is this, is all of us read about killing people and people dying, and we write about it. And so, actually, once we leave the page, we're like, oh, okay, this is all lovely. There's no pent-up anger or anything. We're all like, and everyone is so kind and lovely. It's amazing. I mean, that's been my experience anyway. I have yet to meet, I think, a mystery writer, a suspense writer, a crime writer that hasn't just been utterly lovely.
And I see you're a member of the Misty Writers of America.
I am. I am also currently, as of last month, the president of the Sisters in Crime, the New York City Tri-State Chapter.
Ooh.
And we're working on our website. We've got lots of things. But, yeah, it's again, the community, Sisters in Crime is a great community. Misty Writers, great community. So many helpful, wonderful people.
You know, we interviewed someone who I think is on the board of the Mystery Writers of America, maybe even the head of it right now. Who would that, what was his name? Now I can't remember, but.
It's a great organization, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. He does the website and does they do readings around DC, I think, or at bars and stuff. I wish I could remember.
Yeah. Yeah. The New York chapter is wonderful. And I'm fortunate because I live in New York City. So I can go to the Edgars, which is talk about another fangirl moment.
Oh yeah.
And you're like, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Do you know who that is? Do you know who that is? Do you know who that is?
Well, we're out of time. Unfortunately, but this has been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been so delightful to talk to the two of you. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Mom, do you have some closing words?
Oh, I do. Yeah, well, when you read this book, you'll know this fits it, I think. The only way you can truly repay those who helped you is by helping others.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye, everyone. Bye.